Shadow here. I apologize for my infrequent appearances, but I've been left to rot in the blinding sunshine of Palm Springs during the past 2 years, where I have made attempts to mimic Sonny Bono through my new job as a professional sea lion trainer. Flap, flap. Placing shackles on their fins so that nobody can upload them onto this thing called the internet. Anyway, granted there are only so many pinnipeds who walk around on all fours in a city where the average year-round temperature is 88.98 degrees Fahrenheit, I have tried keeping the sea lions interested in the balls by feeding them massive bottles of tequila and sometimes a little bit of sushi. I don't know if this is a form of cannibalism, but it never hurts to try things. Anyway, this has resulted in a few of the sea lions dying.
The music has stopped, but there's no punchline. The sea lions are dead. They died on Mr. Segundo's watch, and there's nothing he nor you can do about it. These are the types of intrusive narrative interventions you are likely to get when a show like this has gone on too goddamn long. Let's try again.
Anyway, animal rights activists have demanded sea lion funerals from the very organization that was foolish enough to employ me. And I was forced to wear a cheap suit. I'm not sure what any of this meaningless biography has to do with Cole Stryker, the young man who is this show's guest, but then some people manage to get podcast mileage telling you the most boring details you've probably ever heard. It's almost like they view the microphone as a surrogate therapist or a large and warm binky. Well, times have changed, haven't they? Instead of entertaining audiences, we expect them to blow our nose or hold our hands. Well, that's probably one reason why I'm nearly finished with this show. When you have to open up your heart to the larger world, even in a small way, such as caring for a few sea lions, however unsuccessfully, well, it reveals solipsism for the small and petty disease it truly is.
Okay, so I am here with Cole Stryker, who is most recently the author of Hacking the Future. Cole, how are you doing?
I'm great. Good to be here.
So let's get right into it. I read both of your books, and in Epic Win for Anonymous, you described web culture as something so self-referential as to become virtually incomprehensible to those who do not live inside it. You then point out in that same section to how finding out about one cultural reference causes you to look up two additional ones that may have some meaning to that initial reference. And then, of course, you write that it's a skill that only today's younger generation is equipped to grasp. Larger issues, such as the Arab Spring, WikiLeaks, you mention in this book, this is sometimes aligned with Anonymous. But if the default icon is something like Nyancat or Pedo Bear, how can the present online generation, you know, be expected to understand, oh, say, nuance of social issues? What's the incentive for any thinking person over the age of 30 to get on board the online culture you so championed in the first book?
Well, I think that it's the culture specifically to me is interesting because of the way that it enables everyone to be a producer in addition to a consumer. Mm-hmm. And I think that the older generation can get a full hold by looking at sites like Know Your Meme, for instance, is a place where a lot of these memes are explained. And I don't know, you kind of have a couple different questions in there, but
I tend to do that, yes.
I guess one of them is how do older people, you know, understand what this is all about? And
why should they?
I think it's important because this is the future of culture. I think that participatory mimetic culture is going to replace, eventually, mass-produced entertainment within the next 20 years. I think that, A, it's becoming increasingly more difficult for companies to make money by producing big-budget pieces of entertainment, and it's becoming increasingly cheap for 14-year-olds in basements to create compelling entertainment content, not just entertainment but informative content as well.
Yeah.
So I think that we're looking at the future, and if you don't try to wrap your head around it now, you're going to be left behind.
Well, then, on the other hand, one could also argue that there'll be another generation that you will experience, a younger generation who will be faster, who will think smarter, who will have their own memes, who will have their own forms of communication, and you will be just as befuddled as, I suppose, the older web user who is perhaps only looking through, say, Google News, maybe Reddit, if we're lucky. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll fall in the same situation. I mean, is this an inevitable cycle? I mean, why does anybody have to get hooked on to memes? Or why do you have to constantly check Know Your Meme when, in fact, there are greater issues like, say, Syria and so forth?
Well, I think that, for you know, to answer one question, it's very likely that I will one day feel out of touch, almost inevitable. However, I think that there's a difference between my generation and my parents' generation, for instance, in that I was born in the computer age when I grew up learning how to master systems, whereas if my parents get a new DVD player, because the buttons are placed in differently, they don't know how to approach that system. Whereas my mind is wired to instantly learn the inner workings and try to figure out, like, okay, what's different? Where are the buttons located? How is this different from what I know before? And my parents just look at it and they're like, well, this is just alien technology. I can't get my head around it. So I think that's a crucial difference between my generation and my parents. But yeah, who knows what technology will come in the future that'll make me feel just as out of touch as they do.
But why should the generation be dictated by what your mind sees? Isn't that a bit solipsistic, Cole? Maybe we could define some territory here as to, you know, are you saying you're the representation of your generation? I mean, you know, are we overstating things a little bit here?
Perhaps. I look at, you know, young children who have been born in the last 5 years, and I think it was in a book by Clay Shirky, he was writing about his friend's toddler who was trying to figure out where the mouse for the TV was.
Yeah.
By fiddling with the wires, you know, and just assuming that everything was interactive. And I think that that's sort of an evolution of our ways of thinking, that, you know, everyone is going to be able to interact with everything.
So you basically accept the inevitable, that infamous video, which is probably a more damning depiction of what you're describing, of the baby who is sliding the fingers along the magazine,
right,
where the self-righteous parent is saying, see, there's no need for paper. that you say is an inevitable evolution that we're all going to have to deal with? Including bookish people like me.
I mean, I don't use a Kindle myself. I think it's silly to think that things aren't moving inexorably in that direction towards digital.
So just the other day, AntiSec, they stole 1 million Apple unique IDs from an FBI laptop. Mm-hmm. They uploaded it onto Pastebin.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yes. They uploaded it onto Pastebin, which, you write about in this book. You state in the book that Pastebin might indeed be the future of the info leak economy. How much of today's hacking would you say is rooted, if you'll pardon the pun, around text culture or text files? Scarlett Johansson also discovered that she was not immune to this. What extent does our commonplace reliance upon, say, mobile devices, I mean, you know, does this create an even more insecure online identity? I mean, what's the status here?
Absolutely. Well, I think that and Steve Wozniak recently spoke about this, the biggest threat to security right now is the fact that we're putting everything in the cloud.
Yeah.
So your information is no longer secure on a hard drive in your bedroom. It is now on a server farm somewhere. And, you know, now it's not, if a hacker can get into that system, they immediately have access to millions of people's, for instance, credit card numbers or home addresses, and depending on how many layers they're able to penetrate of the security. So I think that, yes, this is going to be something that we're going to have to wrestle with over the next few years, this disparity between what we expect from our technology and what it's able to offer in terms of security.
Or hacking the very networks that people play their games on and so forth. I mean, why aren't people really aware of the fact that so much of their information is so readily hackable, or even readily disseminating through, you know, third parties that Facebook uses and so forth. I mean, is there just no awareness? Is the generation we were describing before, as represented by you, do they just not care about this distinction? Or?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons. One is that up until recently, hackers weren't necessarily prone to publicizing their victories the way they are now. Anonymous, especially, brought about this age of the gloating hacker on Twitter. You know, prior to that, they would gloat in their little, you know, IRC channels and stuff, but it wasn't meant for public consumption. Because they didn't want to get arrested, and any sort of publicity would only make it easier for the feds to track them down, and B, because they weren't interested in impressing anyone that wasn't just as skilled as they are.
Why did they feel the need to start impressing other people or putting a public face? Or are we talking about factions and sectarianism?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think that speaking about Anonymous specifically, a lot of it it's hubris. Younger hackers that manage to pull something off are, they might not necessarily have the ability of one of these autistic geniuses somewhere, you know, who's bringing down some huge corporation and no one ever hears about it. You know, they bring down CIA.gov, which is just a public-facing website with no actual information on it worth stealing. And suddenly they're on Twitter and, you know, speaking to millions about how they just achieved this epic victory.
Why do they feel the need to gloat? Is this a byproduct of like culture? Is this a byproduct of having to ratchet up the great hacking achievements over the years? Is this the more wired world with mobile devices and everything else?
I think you might be right about the light culture thing. Never before have so many people been able to receive a communique of that nature. If you had a hacking victory that you wanted to brag about, you could go on a message board, and the 1,000 people who attend that message board might see it, and then maybe it might get picked up by a blog. Now you have stuff like Facebook and Twitter that enables a massive audience to be galvanized around something like this. And for Anonymous, it's not just about the gloating, it's about getting people excited and hopefully wanting to participate.
Maybe you could delineate between how Anonymous operates through 4chan and how it operates through Twitter. It would seem to me that one, of course, dictated by internal rules, is more likely to fit in with the more the prototypical hacker, the hacker culture that we perhaps celebrated in the 80s and the 90s of people, of the autistic geniuses you suggest, versus Twitter, which is based around following and so forth. How are the two different? Do the two get along? Maybe you can go into that a little bit.
There's a lot of, I would say, condescension from these old-time classical hackers, if you will, towards the pranksters and Anonymous. A, because a lot of Anonymous's attacks don't require a hell of a lot of technical knowledge.
Script kiddies, basically.
Right, right. And also because they are often very principled people who don't find the gloating and the lingo to be very cool. So I think that even if they were to agree with their political aims, whether it's like somehow anti-capitalism or protesting tyranny in the Middle East, that they feel that Anonymous probably does more harm to the cause than good.
But doesn't Anonymous function more or less like the Occupy label? It's an amorphous title that everyone can get behind, and everyone can find some kind of inclusion. Perhaps not specific inclusion, but inclusion nonetheless, so that we're all in this together. Or if someone happens to be on an IRC channel or so forth, we can go ahead and or pastebin the attack on PBS that you mentioned. Yeah. You know, what motivates this? Is it an amorphous identity that allows them to operate in this collective function? Maybe you can describe this.
I think the Anonymous ideology is just solidified enough, or just unified enough, to provide people with a sense, just a lowest common denominator sense of solidarity. But beyond that, like, it means all things to all people. And this is both Anonymous's greatest strength and its greatest flaw, in my opinion, because anybody can take charge and say that they're going to go off and kill Facebook, for instance. And obviously, no one's ever going to accomplish that. And everyone else, all the other members of Anonymous say, oh, well, this isn't the authentic Anonymous. This is some rogue group or just some jackass. So, yeah, I mean, we talked about sectarianism. And even within Anonymous itself, there's hundreds of different opposing views and goals.
Yeah. Yet there are common rules in a forum such as 4chan, and mainstream media is often easily fooled, often to ridiculing effect from the 4chan community, the Oprah expose on Anonymous and so forth. I mean, you know, is there more of an understanding by the mainstream media now that you would say than a couple of years ago? I mean, you yourself put yourself on the line with the first book and were, in fact, heckled and harassed by 4chan. I mean, maybe you're just as part of the problem as Oprah is, or what do we do to understand this? How do we understand a group of people who really don't want to be understood?
Yeah, I still, even a year later after releasing that first book, I still get contacted randomly by trolls who hate my guts and write nasty reviews on Amazon. And I think that part of it is that they simply just don't like people talking about their secret club, even though I felt like I was rather sympathetic to their cause in both books. I think that specifically the 4chan bred version of Anonymous is more trollish in nature and really doesn't care about political ideology, and that they exist simply to mess with people and generate tons of controversy. And I think that the latter group of politically minded Anonymous is more interested in what I'm doing, you know, discussing these issues, and they don't really have a problem with me. It's the one that's the complete, like, nihilist.
The ones who are in it for the lulz.
Yeah, exactly.
But isn't that also a part of the political ethos as well? I mean, you can't just go ahead and take one away from the other, can you?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of lulz in even the most politically minded Anons, like even the ones that are trying to bring down these entrenched corporate powers. And there's certainly at least an aesthetic of lulz where they're using the lingo and they're gloating and basically using like the same terminology that they would use if they had just killed a guy in Halo or some other video game regarding a federal agent.
Getting pawned and all that.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's definitely there as an aesthetic. The specific, I compare it to Tyler Durden's, the character of Tyler Durden in Fight Club, who's just this complete, you know, all he cares about is just fucking shit up, essentially.
Yeah.
those are the ones that, they intrigue me and kind of terrify me at the same time, because you wonder if they're living this double life, and in real life that they're not like that. And I would assume that that's the case for many of them, that this is just an outlet for them to express the id. But I'm sure there are also some genuine psychopaths that are call themselves Anonymous.
Well, okay, so if we're talking about a group that is guided by aesthetic, the most prominent aesthetic, of course, is the V for Vendetta mask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what then would you say is their ultimate ethos, which is probably what people would want to know if we were to acknowledge them as a legitimate group? I mean, are they more driven by lexical keywords, mashing things up into memes, and just constantly perpetuating meme after meme after meme? I mean, you know, how do you get away? How do you distinguish between that and whatever sort of political ethos they stand for, or whatever good that they do?
I mean, I distinguish it in the book by using a capital A when I refer to the politically minded group, and a lowercase a when referring to just random trolls. You can try to synthesize them, but I think it makes more sense to almost consider them as two completely different groups. When they began, they were one and the same. When it was all anti-Scientology.
Yeah.
Over time, the more politically minded members of Anonymous have grown increasingly humorless. and more passionate, and they use lingo from like the 60s counterculture as like "don't lose heart, my brothers" and things like that. And the more trollish Anons would look at that and say, "You got to be kidding me!
Yeah.
Like, this is what we've turned into." You know, they're for pure chaos, and any sort of political goal is to them ridiculous.
But isn't that the iteration of any countercultural hacking movement that we've seen, where, you know, people grow more sour as they grow up, as they have kids, or more libertarian sometimes? We saw a bit of that in the 80s if you hung around in Usenet and mm-hmm. checked out some of that, or looked through the archives. You know, what was once a very fresh countercultural movement became quickly driven towards money, towards entrepreneurship, towards that sort of thing. And of course, the initial enthusiasm or humor that motivated the movement in the first place. I mean, isn't this the function of all ideological groups? How does Anonymous, whether capital A or small a, differ from, you know, hacktivists that came before?
Well, I think that earlier hacktivists didn't were not bred in this memetic culture. The way that 4chan is a pretty unique place. There were places like it that existed before, but not at the same magnitude of just constantly churning weirdness. And most hacktivists don't come to hacktivism from a desire to have fun, or at least previous to Anonymous.
Yeah.
I would think that a lot of politically minded hackers came to that way of life through a desire to achieve political change or to disrupt powerful entities, not to just goof off.
Not predicated on blue boxing or pulling pranks, you know, any of the number of things that Steve Wozniak outlines mm-hmm. in his book.
Yeah, but I don't think they would ever call themselves hacktivists. Mm. I mean, even Steve Jobs did it as well. But I think that's separate. I think Anonymous is sort of the convergence of both of those. You know, I think that it's a natural evolution.
Okay, so it's a natural evolution to go from prank-driven hacker in it for the lulz to hacktivist if you stick around in it too much? Which this sort of implies, I mean, what's the trajectory we're describing here?
I think that it's hard to say whether Anonymous has grown less prankish over the last few years, or if simply that the more political-oriented actions of Anonymous are the ones that are getting all the press, and the there's still that chaotic. I know people that are. You still hear these stories about teenage girls that are getting harassed online, yeah. and people getting doxxed, which is when all their personal identifying information gets leaked to the web. That still happens all the time. And I think that it'll continue to go on as long as people are able to do that. But I think that the more politically minded stuff is what gets the press attention. So it looks like Anonymous is morphing into a more of a political beast, when that might not necessarily be the case. They just have the loudest voices.
Gotcha. You include a chapter called Faces of Anonymity, where you cite a number of examples, a rape victim who needs to talk about her, you know, her past without disclosing what happened, a closet gay teenager. You talk about the trash-talking proprietor of Coke Talk on Tumblr. And these demonstrate, to your mind, why anonymity is important. But for people who are mercilessly bullied online, in fact, which include yourself, mm-hmm. Jesse Slaughter is, of course, the most prominent example. Don't victims of cyberbullying, I mean, don't they have the right to seek some kind of restitution? I mean, you know, is free speech worth the cost of people either killing themselves or being harassed? I mean, you know, why should we permit people to be cyberbullied, often to traumatic effect, by an anonymous mob, and why should we keep free speech going? I'm just curious about mm-hmm. That's one thing I didn't quite get from your book.
Yeah, well, it's definitely like the prominent argument against my whole thesis. And I guess my response would be twofold. The first thing is, that I would like to see as a culture us move towards more, and I mean this is all very pie in the sky, but I would like to see us move towards a sort of sticks and stones mentality about speech online. And then the second part is that trying to mitigate that kind of speech will be technically ineffectual. The bad guys are always going to figure out a way to harass, and I think Facebook is well within its right to clamp down on that sort of thing. But as far as making it illegal, I just think puts either the state or some sort of governing institution into a position of editorial control that I'm not necessarily comfortable giving it.
So is a more open-minded community management making sure that people who are truly vicious don't come out to play? I mean, is that a solution? I mean, clearly self-policing doesn't actually work, especially when you're dealing with something like 4chan, where or this issue of content being churned. I mean, there's almost nothing you can do to stop a video from making the rounds, or a text file from making the rounds, or any kind of constant onslaught of harassment or cyberbullying. I mean, it just does not stop in the worst cases.
Yeah, well, so the question is, what do we do about it? And I don't think that there's a solution on the side of regulation, because that the internet just doesn't work that way. Like, there's a famous quote, "Bits are bits" by Bruce Schneier, that data isn't meant to tell you where it came from. So, I mean, in order to prevent this kind of spread of content that's offensive to certain people is a fool's errand, in my opinion, and trying to do so will only make the internet slightly less free for the rest of us with good intentions.
Okay. Maybe let's try to pinpoint cyberbullying. You have Dana Boyd's remarks in the book, in which she claims that most cyberbullying occurs between, well, people who know each other. There's a 2007 Pew study that 2/3 of all teens say that bullying happens more offline than online. But, in the case of Meghan Meyer, it was clear that there was some online and offline cohabitation. Aside from Boyd's words and this Pew study, what is the nature of cyberbullying? Is it too new for us to truly understand its consequences? Is this something you plan to investigate further in another piece or another book? I mean, well, what
others? This is actually what spawned the original book project. I wrote a three-part story about Jesse Slaughter, who, for your listeners, I'll just sum up real quick, was a 11-year-old girl who was maliciously targeted by 4chan trolls. And she subsequently posted a video of herself tearfully protesting this treatment, and it escalated in another video of her father threatening the trolls to say that if you don't leave my daughter alone, we're going to call the cyber police.
And he backtraced them, and this became a verb that was used by Anonymous, mm-hmm. and is even still used.
There's actually an organization called Backtrace Security.
Yes.
Based on that. But essentially, a literary agent found this coverage and said, I think that this is very interesting and this could be a book. And I said, well, I agree, but I think this community where a lot of trolling comes from is that's the real story, this 4chan and Anonymous stuff. And little did I know at the time that Anonymous was going to become maybe the prominent, cultural force in today's zeitgeist. In terms of big tech stories, Anonymous has got to be the number one or number two story at the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I had no idea, because this was all before LulzSec, and at the time, Anonymous was limited to mostly just Scientology protest. Anyway, to get back to your original question, cyberbullying, I think, is a real issue, but I think it's something that is often used as a... I kind of think of it like the conservative protest against the war on Christmas, in that it's... Part of me wants to think it's sort of a non-issue, in that it it's
harassment's a non-issue.
It's brought up by people who want to regulate the internet as something that is this widespread like threat. And I personally feel like if you want to, there are ways to avoid it. You can leave certain websites if you need to, or disable commenting on your YouTube video, or there's simple ways. You know, sometimes even in Jesse Slaughter's case, all she had to do was just stay offline for a while and people lost interest.
I understand, though, her dad died of a massive heart attack. I mean, you know, who knows if that was exacerbated by the stress of dealing with the incoming pizzas, the constant floods of emails
well,
and phone
calls. Well, I mean, that family appeared to be a mess from way long before she ever got online. I think that there was some child abuse charges levied against him as well.
There was, but does that excuse this kind of cyberbullying?
Absolutely not. Like, I'm definitely not an apologist for bullying. I definitely don't want that to come across. I just think that it's not, I don't think it's some unique thing that we have yet to wrap our minds around and need some sort of new legislative framework to deal with.
What's the best framework then to consider cyberbullying? Is there some sort of, like I said, I was suggesting self-policing or perhaps some sort of anarchistic approach to looking at cyberbullying where people are, I mean, do you think that people are decent enough to stop cyberbullying, that's actually going to be enough to prevent further Jesse Slaughters or the more extreme versions of that?
I think that if you're sending out death threats or something like that, just as you would in the real world, if you were calling someone and leaving death threats on their voicemail, that's an excuse for law enforcement to try to track you down and deal with it. Same thing online. Like if these are genuine, if there's a genuine concern for someone's safety. However, if someone's calling you names and that sort of thing, I think that and again, like every social platform should have the right to deal with it as they see fit. Like I think Facebook, they don't have a perfect system, but it's not 4chan. You know, you're not allowed to just start randomly harassing people like you would elsewhere. So yeah. I think that what I would like to see is an internet where there are safe manicured places where people can go and talk to their grandmothers, and I would also like to see places like 4chan where it's just pure anarchy and you're allowed to do whatever you want.
Well, on this subject, you do bring up SOPA in the book, which of course was a mass protest online, blacking out websites. I blacked out mine during that day because people really resented the idea that the government could shut down a site for copyright infringement. On the other hand, as we saw recently with Steam introducing the class action waiver, and a number of other companies are doing the same thing, people have no problem, number one, surrendering all of their personal data to something like Facebook and so forth. Number two, waiving any rights of you know, any rights to seek legal justice and so forth. Why do you think most people are distrustful of government stepping in while simultaneously willing to give every single shred of data, shooting every photo here, liking every considerable thing there? You know, why do you think there's this two-prong, almost, I don't want to say duplicitous, but certainly it is an interesting counterbalance.
Maybe hypocritical. Well, I think that's changing. I think that people are increasingly becoming concerned about this idea of little brother in addition to big brother. Little brother being corporate entities that are tracking your behavior online and gathering data. No, I mean, I'm with you. I think that it's weird that people don't seem to have the same amount of concern for private companies. However, I don't think that private companies have historically persecuted people for the way that they live their lives, the way that certain governments have. I mean, we're very lucky in the U.S. to have a lot of rich free speech protections, but, you know, not the case elsewhere.
Well, it also boils down to the fact that a lot of people, including people who are technically proficient, they don't know you can actually put that check mark on Firefox to say, I don't want to send my data online, and it's there buried in the security tab. I mean,
are you referring to the do not track
stuff? Do not track data, yeah.
Yeah, so that that's a nice start, and like I use it as well. However, it only works with companies that agree to play ball. Mm-hmm. So if you're and they have a roster of participating companies, and this is another like self-policing method that has arisen out of the ether in the web, but you know, it only works if the company already says like, okay, we're not going to track if you say you don't want us to. And you're just relying on them, their goodwill to do so.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, do you think that perhaps we need government legislation that is going to force websites to disclose what they are collecting while simultaneously respecting the rights of people to do what they want, or yeah, abide by the Hillary Clinton, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
Yeah, I would like to think that self-policing can work in this arena, that companies will be pressured through public opinion to disclose that. I mean, my personal feeling is that if you're uncomfortable with a website's data mining activities, don't visit the website.
So you bought it, you break it, basically.
Yeah, I mean,
and when you visit like a website against your will, or you have a virus in your computer that redirects you to something.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Facebook, where I recognize that Facebook is gathering tons of data about me with every click I make.
And yet you use it.
And I use it. And some privacy activists that I talk to in researching for the book think I'm nuts, yeah, for being on Facebook. I mean, some of them will go so far as to say that Facebook is literally ripped out of an Onion headline that they think is real, that Facebook is a CIA monitoring tool.
Yeah. Then why do you do it? Why do you keep coming
back?
Well,
I'm very careful about what information I give to Facebook. And like I mentioned earlier about the cloud and why that's a big concern. As a corollary to that, another concern that I have is the way that all of these services are sort of creeping together, and their tendrils are reaching out to connect to one another. And I think that there's a concern there when Facebook connects to all these other sites on the internet, so that if I'm leaving a comment on the Huffington Post, Facebook is tracking that because I'm logging in through Facebook. All of these big, you know, tech companies like Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, especially, are working with all you know, hundreds of shadow companies that are gathering your data, and you know, they have. I talk about in the book, they all have weird names like ad tech and just nondescript sounding companies that are doing the bulk of the gathering. So my concern with Facebook is mostly I don't sign up for any sort of Facebook Connect services, which allow me to use Facebook on any platform other than Facebook. And I sacrifice a little bit of convenience, but in the long term, I feel a little bit safer because Facebook is only tracking me when I'm on Facebook.
Well, on the other hand, to sort of put another damper in that sort of paraphrase of the famous Ben Franklin line, there was a Fast Company article about a week ago. I'm sure you checked this out, where there's this new picture tool where it will scan all the details in your photo, any photo you upload, and compile that against what they have in their databases. And it'll be able to tell you who you hung out with, what your age was, if there's perhaps like, you know, like a 7-Up in the bag. Oh, well, that person likes 7-Up. Mm-hmm. All this. So what's to stop, say, Facebook or Google Plus from going back in time and going through all that, the rich mine of photos that you have uploaded over the years, and collecting all the data, grandfathering it in, so to mm-hmm. speak, to their considerable data that they have upon you already? I mean, you know, it's something I think we should be concerned about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that. And I talk about in the book also the security camera technology that allows people to cameras to recognize faces from 1,000 yards away or something like that. And Facebook has this database of, you know, nearly a billion people now, and they're all, you know, they all have a profile image, which is essentially a link between their personhood and wherever they go throughout, you know, their, you know, wherever they're photographed. And as Philip Zimmerman says, I can't encrypt my face. And that was something that he said to me in an interview where I asked him about, can we rely purely on the market and on technology to provide ways to safeguard ourselves? And his point was, by saying I can't encrypt my face, is that yes, we do have to try to fight some of these things through legislation. And as much as I like to rely on the market and on technology to say that everything's going to be fine, you know, in the coming years, I think that I might have to alter that position a little bit as some of this technology comes out.
Well, you have said in maybe in the first book where you basically declared, well, I can kind of negotiate what I reveal through Facebook because, there's, as you said just now, I will only reveal certain bits of data. However, with Sabu, he made one particular mistake, mm-hmm. Logging in to IRC with a traceable IP address. Next thing you know, he's an informant. There's also something to be said for technology that might be introduced down the line where it will be able to detect how we impersonate other identities and other selves. And then, of course, there's the issue of, like, well, that's quite a bit of energy to pretend to be about six different people depending upon the service. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we reckon with that? Is this just going to be a way of life where we put all this energy into pretending to be a different person depending upon what the site is, what the audience is, and then we can't necessarily sort everything out and becomes almost like a Philip K. Dick nightmare? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer for that question. I think that it's going to be I argue in the book that the identity issue is going to be the primary, like, battleground in the next decade for personal freedom. And I think that it's going to be a lot harder to impersonate or to create a persona. Maybe if you're not impersonating an existing living being, you're creating a fake persona. That's going to be increasingly difficult. However, I think that when I'm feeling optimistic, I'll say that there's always going to be places like 4chan and the deep web and really anywhere that's not Facebook and other closed proprietary platforms where that stuff will be fair game. So
the dark net is actually going to be secure enough for people to buy illicit drugs or possibly, like, arrange a hit. I mean, people, of course, will always move somewhere else, but I'm wondering how much of the darknet was really predicated upon happenstance. The great sort of savant who created Bitcoin, who seemed to know a little bit of everything, who happened to be there at the right place at the right time, and aligned with all these people seeking dark interests, you know, where there's every conceivable Rule 34 transgression under the sun. You know, I mean, will people always have another place to go? Is the darknet, I mean, what's the lifespan of the darknet, do you think?
Well, I think that the history of hacking is a history. I think of it like a tug of war between people trying to have information and keep it safe, and on the other side, people trying to get at that information. So, just in broad philosophical terms, I think that conflict will continue to go on because there's always someone smarter on either side pushing it forward, you know, like tugging it a little bit. And there's this concept back and forth of, you know, for instance, the FBI or the Fed, some, you know, federal department, figuring out a way to get at users on the deep web or dark net. And then some open source genius mathematician figuring out some sort of encryption technology that negates that new advance. And I believe that push and pull is going to continue indefinitely, simply because that seems to be the nature of communication technology.
As long as computers exist, there will always be hackers. There will always be people wanting to look for a way around the brick wall.
Exactly. I mean, this is really the crux of my argument against regulation, is that no matter how much you try to lock down identity on the internet, there's always going to be people, with good intentions or bad, to figure out a way around it. And then the rest of us who, you know, just want to speak our minds online, our freedom will be just slightly less powerful.
What would you say the next iteration of Anonymous might be, or the next hacktivist group? What is the future of hacktivism?
It's funny. I feel like I have a different answer for this every couple weeks. When Sabu was arrested and when some of the other prominent members of LulzSec were arrested, I thought, well, this probably means that we're going to be seeing a lot less of this kind of hacktivism, because it, contrary to what we thought, a lot of these hacks were pulled off by a close-knit group of people. And then we just had this huge Mac ID leak, which presumably had nothing to do with the core LulzSec group, because most of them are in prison. So again, I think it's a matter of just, there's always going to be some genius who finds a loophole, and the nature of systems is that there's always a way to break through. You know, this, the cryptography is a practice that's goes back as far as the Egyptians. You know, there's always someone that's going to figure out a better lock, and there's always someone that's going to figure out a better key.
There's always going to be somebody who's going to press the power button off.
I think that Anonymous will, I think it's going to continue to diverge away from its lulzy roots and become more just straight hacktivism. And I think that the lulzy stuff is going to continue as well, in another form. But
what form do you think that might be?
Well, just the rampant indiscriminate stuff, that's not, you know, that's usually accomplished by one or two guys goofing off and harassing some other person mercilessly. I think that the kind of wide-scale collaborative hacktivism that we saw over the last couple years, especially with the DDoS, which requires hundreds or thousands of people to participate, that's going to go away. Because although there are ways to safeguard yourself if you want to participate, it's just too risky. You know, there are things like honeypots and other forms of monitoring that the FBI can use to throw you in jail if you get caught.
Would you say that the FBI is better equipped now to infiltrate, say, the dark net or IRC channels? I mean, they were clearly there for Sabu. Is the future really a secure place for those who want to go completely anonymous, or will, of course, it be snatched away once someone hands over the records or the logs to the authorities?
Well, from what I've learned in talking to people who work in security, it would require a massive rebuilding of the internet, so drastic that we would almost have to call it something else. Like it wouldn't be the internet as we know it today to completely, with 100% certainty, know where a given piece of data is coming from. So I do think that there's always going to be something like the deep web out there. At least I hope so, because if there isn't, that means that we're dealing with some other system that's, you know, basically monitored 100% by the state or some corporate entity that's been given this responsibility. I wouldn't want to live in that world.
I suppose we'll find out in the next few years. Cole, I think that's a good time to end this conversation. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay.